You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Lately, we hear different entertainers talk about how precarious their industry is nowadays and their fears of saying the wrong thing and getting canceled or otherwise vilified for their work. There's also talk about how show business used to be much more open and free and that people now have become too sensitive and restrictive over what people should and shouldn't say or do. Turns out this is not a new thing. Entertainers have been feeling this way for generations. Here are TV personalities and comedians Fred Allen and Steve Allen talking about the industry in a 1955 NBC show reflecting on comedian Will Rogers.
I think the people today are in the humor field their limits are much greater than Will's were, because Will could talk about anything politically or any phase of life in our country, and the people accepted it in the humor in which he delivered it. But today we have a great many pressure groups and a great many self-appointed people who are ready to criticize without being ready to help, you know.
These are very touchy times.
Those are quoted in our guest's new book about how the cultural response to entertainment has changed and some of the themes that have remained the same over time. You can join in at 800-642-1234. How have you seen our standards change for what is culturally acceptable in our entertainment? Were you glad to see those changes, or do you think we lost something? Are there certain topics you've seen people get more or maybe less upset about over time? Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email ideas@wpr.org. Cliff Nesteroff is an author and comedy historian who writes about comedy in the entertainment industry. His latest book is called Outrageous, A History of Showbiz and the Culture Wars. Cliff, welcome back to Central Time.
Thank you very much. I absolutely love that clip you played. I thought it was just incredible.
Credit to our producer, Lauren, for digging up that clip. But we knew about it from your book, and it really illustrates. That's about a 70-year-old clip, and these things that I think we think are new, cancel culture or woke entertainment industry arguments, things like that, they've been around since way before 1955. This has a long history. Can you talk about what led you into digging into that history?
Well, whenever I hear this refrain that you can't say anything anymore, it just seems to be contradictory when you look at the actual evidence. That clip is from 1955, and the two things that were happening in America at that time period, on the left side of things and on the right side of things, were McCarthyism on the right side of things and the burgeoning civil rights movement on the left-wing side of things. So Brown versus Board of Education was 1954. That clip was 1955. McCarthyism was at its height at that moment. And so you had these two sort of elements that were jockeying to suppress different things for different reasons. And one of the cliches you hear today on talk radio and cable news is that it used to be the right-wingers that tried to suppress and censor, the Jerry Falwells and the Pat Robertsons, and that today it's the opposite. It's the left-wingers on college campuses that are trying to suppress things. But the reality is that both occur concurrently at all times. So, like I mentioned, in the 1950s, you have the civil rights movement on one end trying to remove racial stereotypes and books like Little Black Sambo from schools and trying to eliminate the last vestiges of blackface that were still around. And on the other hand, you had people on the right that were trying to suppress things that criticized American foreign policy or American history, tried to suppress things that, were of a more critical or progressive point of view. Criticism of religion was very much taboo in those days. So when I look at the history of show business and the history of comedy, it seems obvious to me that we have more freedom of speech today, not less. Compare what you can say today on satellite radio and podcasts to what you could not say for the entire existence of AM and FM radio. Compare what you can say on cable television or streaming services to what you could not say and still can't say on network TV, ABC, CBS, NBC. You can swear now, you can criticize things politically now, you can criticize religion now, and you can express sexuality now. All of those things would have gotten you in severe trouble in the past. And I don't just mean people getting upset, but comedians would get arrested if they swore on stage for a century. Things didn't really start to change until the 1970s. And even then, on network TV and traditional radio, you still couldn't swear. So I would say there are less taboos today, not more, even though there are some taboos, most of which are focused on what people consider to be bigotry. And sometimes it is bigotry, and sometimes it's just the perception of bigotry. But that's where the majority of taboos today lie, is in the realm of bigotry.
And we think of, at least in political punditry, the concept of culture war seems to have come up and gotten to be a big phrase in the United States just over the last couple few, maybe decades. But it seems like you see that battle over culture and how it's presented in our popular media as going back, again, 150 plus years.
Yes, the phrase is new, but the concept isn't. And for me, I sort of see the culture war as not merely about the culture, but exploiting the culture for political reasons. So, for instance, a politician will exploit religion. They will claim to be a good Christian and their opponent is some sort of heathen when the politician, this hypothetical politician, is exemplifying all the sins, whether it be adultery, whether it be lying, whether it be fraud, you know. So these sort of cultural markers are used to exploit and to divide. And that was true going back decades. Certainly McCarthyism was a 1950s version of the culture war, a way to demonize your political adversary, marginalize them, and to acquire political power for oneself. And that is still what we see with the culture war. It really is about eliminating the opponent, eliminating the adversary, and acquiring and retaining power by exploiting people's fears, by exploiting people's beliefs. That essentially is what the culture war is all about.
Talking to Cliff Nesteroff about his new book. It's called Outrageous, A History of Showbiz and the Culture Wars. You can join in with your thoughts on these issues or your questions at 800-642-1234. So many moments in your book, Cliff. I want to go back to vaudeville, and this might surprise people. A lot of protests from Irish-American groups, I think German-American, Jewish-American groups, African-American groups, criticizing their portrayal on the vaudeville stage. Talk to us a little bit about that era.
Yes. Well, in the 1890s and the early 1900s, ethnic characterizations were very, very common. In fact, the idea of a malapropism, which we see today still in characters like Borat or Ali G, the idea of somebody mangling the English language and getting a laugh by saying a word that sounds similar to the word they mean, but having a different definition. That whole concept really begins in vaudeville, and you had all these sort of parodies of various immigrant groups. Immigration was at a high point in the 1870s, the 1880s, and the 1890s, and the new arrivals were the ones that were parodied on the vaudeville stage, whether it was Jewish immigrants, Irish immigrants, Italian immigrants. It was very common to see what now we would consider stereotypes being portrayed on the stage. But as these immigrant groups started to become assimilated, and as they had children, and as those children grew up to be adults, they had less patience for being ridiculed on the vaudeville stage. And there were a number of protest movements that emerged in the late 1890s and the early 1900s, objecting to what they considered slanderous portrayals on the stage. And so there was a group called the Clan na Gael. They were an Irish betterment group. They were not as militant as the IRA or the Molly Maguires, but I think they were certainly inspired to a certain degree by those militant protest movements. They objected to people on the stage making fun of Irish people or putting on a thick accent or doing a little jig, you know, all the common Irish stereotypes that were not necessarily performed with malice, but they were not performed with any real footing in reality either. And the Clan na Gael objected to this, and they asked vaudeville theater managers to stop booking Irish stereotype comedians. Theater managers, vaudeville bookers said, no, I mean, people enjoy this type of comedy. You need to get a sense of humor, and we're not going to stop doing this. And the Clan na Gael said, well, if you don't, we're going to take matters into our own hands, which is exactly what they did. Wherever Irish stereotype comedy was performed, soon shows were sabotaged. People would storm the stage, stomp their feet, blow whistles, drown out the comic, boo the comic, throw things at the stage. And this continued for several years until vaudeville theater managers realized, well, this is just not worth the trouble, and they did start to eliminate Irish stereotypes from the stage. Now, there were several newspaper editorials written at the time. We're talking about 1902, 1903, 1904. Several newspaper editorials saying this is terrible for the state of comedy, the state of free speech. How dare these people try and bully us into what we can and cannot say. Other newspaper editorials defended them and said, well, maybe it is time that we get rid of some of these stereotypes and try a new form of comedy. But a lot of the editorials said, you know, what's next if we buckle to Irish protest groups? What's going to happen? Are black patrons going to object to blackface? Then what? It'll be the death of comedy. And they sounded the alarm. And it did inspire other groups to protest. Italian immigrant groups were tired of seeing themselves being portrayed as organ grinders, saying Mamma Mia on the stage, and that eroded. And bit by bit, these protest movements had some effect. And just like today, there was this debate about whether that was a good thing or a bad thing, but it did contribute to the evolution of vaudeville comedy at the time.
We're talking to author and comedy historian Cliff Nesteroff about his new book. It's called Outrageous, A History of Showbiz and the Culture Wars. You could join in at 800-642-1234. Do you have questions about the history of different kinds of protests, about content in comedy, on stage, on the screen? What changes have you seen in your lifetime between what the culture at large views as acceptable in entertainment, maybe what you yourself view as acceptable or otherwise? Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. We'll pick up the conversation coming up on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. That's The Twist by Hank Ballard and the Midnighters, later covered by Chubby Checker. You might think of it as an old-timey dance where you rotate your midsection back and forth, as instructed by the lyrics. Back when it was first released in 1959, it was seen as so provocative and controversial, it was banned in cities, even countries around the world. It's an example of how the public battle over what's socially acceptable in entertainment has changed over time. We're talking about that with our guest Cliff Nesteroff, author of the new book, Outrageous, A History of Showbiz and the Culture Wars. You could join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Let's turn to the mid-1900s again. Actually, Cliff, you see an organized campaign by groups like the John Birch Society, started here in part in Wisconsin, and others targeting degrading forms of entertainment, including The Twist.
Sure. I mean, The Twist was considered real salacious when it came out, that it was some sort of a demonstration of sexuality on the dance floor. And the fact that young people, teenagers, took to it was considered very alarming to older people. But this had been an old argument going back to the teens, at the days of the tango and the foxtrot. Even the waltz was considered somewhat salacious. And dancing was really a controversial issue throughout American history, the Calvinist influence and the various sort of puritanical influences were very much opposed to dancing in general. They considered it an avenue to sexuality, which in a way it was. But if you look at The Twist, I mean, it's so quaint compared to twerking. But the sort of controversy that surrounded it, it was very similar to many of the controversies throughout history. And a lot of that controversy was had a religious basis. It was sort of the pulpit that was objecting to these things and claiming that it was contributing to the downfall of America. And I have a line in the opening of the book where I talk about how throughout American history, and this is still true today, people always think that things are much worse today than they were in the past. And people often mistake change for decline. And you still see that happening today. And there's always this sort of doomsday prophecy. And today it's not coming from preachers. It's coming from secular commentators, or at least people who purport to be secular. I think there is an evangelical influence behind it, claiming that things have never been so bad in the culture and that things used to be better. But the same arguments that existed that exist today existed back then.
Let's bring on a caller at 800-642-1234. Jeff is with us in Superior. Jeff, hi.
Hi, good afternoon. I believe that in America we've lost our sense of humor. And what I mean by that is, in Canada, I live near the border up here, so I get a couple radio programs from Canada that are hilarious. And I don't know anybody that listens to the radio or has an American radio program that they listen to and laugh at. I think we've lost radio as an influence in our culture.
Jeff, thanks a lot for the call. I think a lot of people laugh at me more than with me anyway, but thanks a lot for the call, Jeff. But Cliff, radio comedy was big once upon a time. And actually, one of the examples you give in the book, Stan Freberg, who had a radio show, albums, and a book, was one of those figures that became controversial after being targeted. Can you talk a little bit about his story?
Yeah, well, his book was an autobiography that was written years later, but in the 1950s, at the height of Stan Freberg's popularity, he was a well-known satirist. He didn't consider himself a comedian, per se. He certainly considered himself specifically a satirist. He would parody things like the Harry Belafonte Calypso craze and Lawrence Welk and a number of other things. But he had several records that were banned. And frequently, when he appeared on TV, and he was very popular, he was censored. He wanted to do a sketch about cigarette smoking and the idea that doctors, 9 out of 10 doctors, were recommending cigarettes. Well, that was taboo in American culture. In the 1950s, the sponsors yielded a lot of power, both on radio and television. Whatever the sponsor didn't want on the air, it didn't happen. That has changed drastically today with streaming services. You know, with the Dave Chappelle controversy and Netflix, Netflix can afford to not buckle to protest because there's no advertising on their platform. Whereas if Dave Chappelle had done his same routines on a network show that had commercials, people who objected could then target the advertiser, and then you would see something be removed or censored. So in the days when commercial sponsors really controlled comedy, Stan Freberg frequently came into discord with his intent and what the sponsors wanted, which was to offend absolutely nobody. And of course, satire always has a target, so it is going to ruffle some sensibilities. Ultimately, Stan Freberg became so frustrated with the fact that he was frequently being censored on American television in the 1950s, he got an offer from a TV producer in Toronto who said, "Why don't you come up to Canada? We'll let you do all the material that's been censored by network television." And this included comedy that parodied bigots in the South who were opposed to integration in schools, and the aforementioned cigarette smoking routine.
That goes back to Canada for you there, Jeff. Thanks for the call. Cliff Nesteroff is with us. His book is Outrageous, A History of Showbiz and the Culture Wars. And Cliff, mentioning race, through decades and decades, one of the things that people got offended about was the presence of a black entertainer where white people might see or hear them, or black and white people together on a stage or soundstage, as the case may be. How much protest and boycott and even violence did that lead to?
Well, it depends on which era and which part of the country we're talking about and which situation. But black performers were welcome on what you might call a white stage back in the day. But there were sort of differences in and expectations in terms of quote-unquote manners in those days. So, for instance, a black performer could perform for a white audience, but they were not allowed to address the audience. A black performer on the stage could not look down at the white audience and say, "Hello, sir, where are you from?" That was considered taboo, and that was also considered a grounds to be fired if you were a black comic. And that stood strong for several decades. It wasn't until the post-war period that that started to change ever so slightly. There was a comedian completely forgotten today named Timmy Rogers. And Timmy Rogers was one of the first black comedians to address white audiences. Up to that point, most black comics dressed in a costume. They were very broad. They used a fake name like Baby Seals or Pig Meat. Timmy Rogers went on stage using his own name, dressed in his own clothes, and he performed at a place called the Beverly Hills Country Club, which was actually in Kentucky. It was a mafia-run nightclub. And when he went on stage in his regular clothes and started to address the audience, the mafia objected. They said, you cannot act like a white person on stage. How dare you? They fired him. He was not booked there again. That was in 1948 or 49. Dick Gregory came along in the early 1960s at the height of the civil rights movement, and he sort of broke the mold. He went on stage in front of white audiences in San Francisco and talked about the civil rights movement. And because there was so much tension in America at the time regarding school integration, voting registration, you know, all the civil rights actions that were occurring at the time, it was like a big valve that opened. And to hear a black comedian make fun of racists on stage was incredibly cathartic in the early 1960s. So from then on, from the moment that Dick Gregory became popular, that started to change. And for the first time, you started to see a lot of black comedians being booked in white nightclubs, performing for white audiences. But up until that point, it had been largely taboo. And a lot of the controversies surrounding rock and roll were also related to race and racism and so-called race mixing. The idea of black kids and white kids dancing together totally upset and frustrated their parents, older racists, who really objected to this. So a lot of the objections to rock and roll and to the dance crazes that came about had to do with the mixing of black and white people.
And we'll leave it there. Cliff, thanks again for joining us today.
My pleasure. Thank you.
That's Cliff Nesteroff, author, comedy historian who writes about comedy in the entertainment industry. We've been talking about his new book, Outrageous, A History of Showbiz and the Culture Wars.